whole idea that we got to bring to a reality.
Yeah. I guess lastly, do the kids know, like, how excited are they about the superstars?
Coming to the skate park last few days just to come skate. Just everybody's just like, so is it true? And I'm just like, I don't know. And like, I had a hard time keeping it a secret, honestly, because yeah, I just think it's so cool that not only do we get a new park, but we get like this interest sort of, you know, from beyond Smithers borders, and Terrace is here and a bunch of Prince George kids. And yeah, like it's really cool that this event is turning out as big as it is, and just seeing a lot of kids just like, they don't want to get off their skateboards.
Yeah.
It's rad.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, fam.
It looks like a few trucks have just pulled up. And we're going to find out if those rumors are actually true.
Among the throngs of kids skating, their parents watching, and people of all ages waiting, all of a sudden, with very little pomp and circumstance, Tony arrived.
Are you guys excited yet? Yeah! Can you guys stand at the bottom of the hill? All right, we got to give them a little bit of space. So we're going to start with our traditional welcome. Come on up, ladies.
Hi, Cycle D, Ramona. I'm from the Lipsiliu clan, and we are here to help welcome the expansion of the park. We're Akaya Hosley, which means bringing it back to life. And we are going to start off with honoring the territory that we're on. This is unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en, and we are going to start off with a Gidimdan Kaskan song, which means small bear.
Bringing these skaters to Smithers is a massive boon to the skate park and all of the partners involved. Sarah shared with me a part of their visit that struck me as unique to the Wet'suwet'en territory that Smithers resides on, and to consider the history of the land that we play on.
The morning of the 29th, I should mention in terms of the partnership with Kayla and the Office of Wet'suwet'en Youth and Youth from Wet'suwet'en. Really, her team came up with this, a learning on the land session. From 10 to 12, we took the athletes up to the lookout, which is on the way up the Hudson Bay Mountain. And she and her team and her youth did a learning on the land session. They taught the group Wet'suwet'en words. They had maps of the territory. And they took us through a few different ceremonies, and it was incredible. They did drumming, and I could see that the athletes, many of them, Tony included, had never experienced anything like that before. They talked about the murdered and missing Indigenous women, and also why that lookout was important in terms of the town's history. It was just phenomenal. People were crying. It really moved people, and this is the kind of thing when you partner with Indigenous organizations that you get so connected to the history of that place, and it was probably my favorite part of the entire 3 days that we had them here.
Thank you to Sarah, Patrick, and Rob for their interviews at the Smithers Skate Park when Tony Hawk, a 58-year-old man, absolutely shredded in Smithers. And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenay, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. This is edition 267. And on this program, I'm going to be speaking with a longtime community organizer, an artist, performer, drag queen, LGBTQ activist, someone standing up for the rights of people living with HIV, Jordan Arsenault. I spoke with Jordan in regards to his work for a long time at a community-based level. I recalled the organizing that Jordan did in the context of the last conservative government in Canada, and the ways that frameworks of criminalization were used to try to win a popular vote. This was in regards to mandatory minimum prison sentences that were pushed through the last time the Conservatives were in power in Canada. And I recorded this conversation because I was thinking about how important it is for us to hear the voices of community organizers as the Conservative Party of Canada continues to build support. They won significant vote and seat increases in the last federal election in Canada. The threat is there, and I think it's important to hear from grassroots voices that can speak specifically to the ways that conservative policies are damaging for many communities. So it's in this context that I recorded my conversation with Jordan Arsenault. So here it is.
We're in Montreal, and recently there was a community event titled something close to confronting the conservative agenda of Poilievre. And this was a community event and a discussion with different community groups that was aiming to sort of think about what the effects of a conservative government in Canada would be on the experiences of different marginalized communities, Indigenous folks, trans communities, and more generally, I think the panel was looking at also like the realities of, you know, attacks on the environment that happened under the Conservatives. But the panel was challenging in the sense that it opened a conversation, which was what community activists do if there is another conservative government, and what should we be thinking about? Mm-hmm. And coming out of that, I was talking with my friend Jordan Arsenault, who is a translator, a community activist, an artist, performer, many things, wonderful things.
So many hats.
And if you could just introduce yourself.
Sure.
And maybe just share some initial thoughts that are broadly sort of point to why this topic is important to you, addressing the conservative threat, as it were.
Sure. The 2020, late 2020, so I think the Harper majority came in 2009. So that's something I'm going to keep in mind in describing this. My bio is born in New Brunswick, 1980. Moved to Montreal in 2000. I am a gay man living with HIV who does a lot of work with the HIV positive community, and I make some art and I do epidemiological summaries right now and translation. My period of the Harper years was really, really, really foundational for my belief that sometimes you're gonna lose and that's okay, is how I talk about the Harper years. And I talk about that in two different ways. So I had the privilege of getting to present kind of on a same topic, different question. And the question was, what is community mobilizing? What is what we call activism, which has been has been besmirched in the discourse. My own brother-in-law, I think brother-in-law ideology is what I call the advent of recent forms of conservatism that are quite performative and that stymie us as people who believe in a better life being possible for everyone, but that requires a lot of care and intervention, that the resting state of the state is enacting oppression is one of our foundational beliefs, I think, among progressives. The resting state of brother-in-law ideology is that the state castrates you, is that this state oppresses the most efficacious of its members, that this state is nothing but a gang of, like the way Brexiteers see the European Union, it's just a bureaucracy of tax dollar wastage is sort of how the state is described in brother-in-law ideology. And so brother-in-law ideology picks up on a whole bunch of other knee-jerk, shitty, in-shittification ideas. So this is pre-brother-in-law ideology. This was an almost classical period of activism for me in that what we had was a dismembered left. We had a dead Jack Layton to deal with, I think, was around that time. R.I.P. I went from working at a community organization that assisted youth in harm reduction to working at a magazine, and working at a magazine called 2B that was one of several that dealt with the Craigslist demise of the early 2010s. I had the unusual privilege of being very aware of all themes regarding over-criminalization, or what you might call, what jurists call the misapplication of the law. One of those was HIV criminalization, which is that due to legal precedent, non-disclosure of your status to a sex partner is a crime in Canada and continues to be. So around that time, I was really aware of this because I also was working at, as an advocacy journalist. I had the privilege of working for a Maoist editor, publisher who was, a pro-LGBT gay man who was a terrible boss, but had really had activist journalism in his soul. You know, it's a very strange thing to work with somebody who's a terrible person, and with great politics. It was a good learning. In that same moment, a bunch of my friends who ran a really unprofitable website called Forget the Box, we all noticed that the an omnibus bill was coming down the tubes, and the omnibus bill C31 at the time under Harper. And I actually, when we go back to my house, I'm going to see if I have the banner, because I would love to get a picture of that for your records, is that I kept this banner that my frenemy Jeff made for us, because he didn't feel like coming out to any of the demos or doing any of the work that we were doing, but he really believed in it. And on his long-term disability that year, he sewed us a banner by hand. So moving at the moment, because I think about the ways that people think they can't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in these moments, it's also like so overwhelming to think about the effort that had to be made to oppose Harper.
Yes.
And
this guy Maxime noticed that all of our messaging was primarily in English. We were trying to make noise around Bill C-31. Bill C-31 was the worst thing that the Harper government did legally, which is what Rona Ambrose and that entire gang of Ayn Rand reading neoliberal Pumbas to a man and a woman, each one of those people, even the homosexuals, even the women who describe themselves as feminists, even the ones with quadruple degrees from all the best schools, all of them bought hook, line, and sinker into the belief that Canada had gone careening too close to like a European-style big debt, big government control of the state by a presumed progressive bureaucracy and state apparatus, and that the liberal years have been fat and wasteful, and that we had to tighten the reins to keep Canada's debt rating down or something. This idiotic belief that Canada could have ever, ever have become more of a fiefdom to international neoliberalism than it already was, and that that was somehow going to be prevented through austerity measures, through an outright elimination of all pro-immigrant, pro-queer, pro-trans, pro-social housing movement. So this was the same period where we had the very, very, oh no debt vibe of the whole world. So from our mayor, Tremblay, at the time, the most forgettable mayor in the history of Montreal, absolutely forgettable. You can't even read anything negative about him, because the only negative thing he did was say, oopsie, everyone's moving to the burbs. We're going to run out of tax money to keep the lavish life we lead with our Maison de la Culture and our, I don't know what else in Montreal works for you. But at the time, a lot of the arrondissement had a great deal of people working for them in everything from environmentalism to gymnasiums to, you know, drop-in centers. And there was a rather rich apparatus here if you compare it to people who would come here from New Orleans or who would come here from, trying to think where another friend who made that, you know, from places where... Hi, kids. Where there's no subsidized nothing, if you really looked at it, we had it pretty good at the time. We were aware that it was all delicate and interruptible and defundable and that the buildings are falling apart, right? Tremblay said, no, we need more condos, and it was kind of free reign. So a lot of the Charbonneau Commission that later came out about Montreal's corruption and how corrupt all the developing was, that was just one mayor of absolute beige... beige. The man was navy and beige. Tremblay had nothing on his agenda then. He was untouchable from that corruption. All he did was say, sure, make St. Henry a palatial enclave of wealth rather than what it is. Sure, let UDM do that thing that they're doing, whatever they're doing, also more enclaves. And so bring tax dollars back to the city and save Montreal from... suburban flight, keep its tax dollars up. Tremblay was not going to be an austerity mayor who's going to then eliminate all of that funding. I honestly believe that part of his beige and navy was that he wanted to just kind of keep Montreal able to do, keep Montreal rich, in that Montreal poor was not good for the mayor. I think that's what was behind it. But what we were doing was something about criminalization. And criminalization was up for a Supreme Court challenge when it came to HIV non-disclosure, which came out with also a very beige and navy solution, a very middle-of-the-road solution for HIV criminalization came about at the same time as Bill C-31. This decision is called Mabior DC. I can explain it in a separate capsule. Beep, beep, there's the time sound machine coming up. I'm kidding.
So I will mention... Just sort of to rewind, I mean, Jordan, you've situated us in a very particular time period. Yeah. So you've situated us in Montreal in like 2009,
10, 11, 12.
Yeah, like 2009, 10, 11, 12. Mm-hmm. You've talked about sort of an austerity approach from the city administration. On a federal level, you had a conservative government.
Pro-private ownership.
Of course, pro-private ownership. Yeah. And was driving home this sort of policy set that was pushing for austerity, but at the same time was also working to enact policies that would not only push austerity, but were also criminalizing a bunch of communities. So maybe we can get into, you mentioned the omnibus bill that you organized against, and thank you for situating where you were at the time, because... It was from that context that you were organizing.
Yeah.
So it's good to sort of get a picture of where you were.
There's so much philosophy behind it, and I appreciate that summary, Stefan, because there's something going on here where it was an interesting moment in that a lot of us had like the worst interactions that many of us might have had with a conservative politician was almost at like the municipal level. Mm-hmm. Like none of us had like a baddie prime minister before, so... When around the time where Harper stopped giving press conferences, that was probably then at the time one of the nadirs of Canadian politics. When he stopped doing that, it was an announcement of the beginning of this agenda that the so-called, liberal media, which is absolutely the most... is a murky concept, but the concept was the concept that benefited us, which is that when I wanted to do a demo against HIV criminalization, I knew someone who worked at Le Devoir. I knew someone who worked at Radio Canada. There were people of progressive minds with a lens on the world that injustice was most likely occurring most of the time. So the omnibus bill is particularly dangerous because an omnibus is when several acts of the criminal code, in this instance, can be changed, in this case for the worst, through one bill. And the parliament, which was a majority, horrifyingly, could approve of the whole damn thing, affecting numerous future applications of numerous laws. And they got to call it the Safe Streets and Communities Act, which is the bullshit of all time, but it does involve a lot of lisping. So I like to call it the Safer Streets and Communities Act. What's going on out there? They got to, in their constant vilification and fear of a sexual mistreatment of minors became this very front flag. So beware, everyone. If someone is saying that what they're doing is about getting pedos, you know that they are activating a foundational belief that we almost all have. 99.9% of the entire world knows that the sexual mistreatment of minors is wrong. That is all they had to work with this bill. That's what they got people in with. We're going to be tough
kind
on...
Like a hook.
Tough on the sexual mistreatment of minors. La, 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 la. And that's why they led with this unbeatable bill, is that to critique it, then that was the trap. You, it would sound like you were trying to defend people who sexually mistreat minors, and that was horrifying. The rest of the bill, harsher fines for for growing cannabis, harsher fines for violent crime, harsher fine, harsher time, and the worst of it all, the most decried aspect of it all, mandatory minimum sentences. Yeah. This is similar to the California's three-strike rule,
yes,
where if you kill three people, you'll get more prison time in America. If you steal three times, you may or may not get prison time. The judge is supposed to adjudicate, was this person stealing because they were poor, high, was it violent, what kind of day, did they try and ask forgiveness, are they willing to do community service, yada yada. I saw kids like this at Head and Hands. Kids who had been kept out of...
A community organization.
Yeah, who had been kept out of the criminal justice system and its early iterations by judges who were given their traditional purview of being able to decide whether prison was necessary to keep this community safe. I'm not going to get into abolitionist politics for this purpose. We went for a really more a Civil Liberties Association kind of approach that was picking up arguments of the nature, you can't have mandatory minimum sentences for prisons that are hellscapes of punishment and have nothing to do with preventing crime, everything to do with sadistic punishment of people who are typically already dealing with different kinds of oppression. The omnibus bill created a bogeyman of a pot-growing, pedophilic, evil parole condition busting bastard out there that we got to get tough on. You can get tough on those people in a number of different ways other than an absolutely baroque omnibus bill that covered so many different acts that to this day the Trudeau government can't undo it all because it's so much work. That's what you've done. You've shredded the notion of the judge's ability to be what? An arbitre. To be arbitrary. Judges should be allowed to be arbitrary about sending people to fucking prison because there's no room in there. People have only negative outcomes from that. And there is so much recidivism that you can't even argue that there's anything reformatory about prisons. Prison for nonviolent crime is idiotic. Everyone knows that. But the most idiotic thing, the most dangerous thing, the most harbinger of a hellscape that we live in now about it, the mandatory minimum sentences had been decried by every single legal scholar in the world. It had been horrifying for Michigan, for California, for everywhere that had ever been put into place. It had horrifying consequences of overstaffed prisons, social deconstruction. The most efficacious thing it can do is to make you believe that your neighbor's probably bad and that there's no point organizing because most people are out there being drug-growing pedophilic bastards. That is all false. It was a fog of negative views of the social project, that we're in this together. They live in ideological enclaves, and the omnibus crime bill was so retrograde that in that moment, I had the privilege of knowing other absolutely indie, unpaid journalists like yourself who thought to ourselves, this is wronger than I can sleep on. I need to be able to sleep. I will not be going to jail for this. And this is a great, great lesson from my friend Noam. I asked him once, why do you do so much volunteering at the Prisoner Correspondence Project? Mm-hmm. Do you think you, as a trans man, might eventually... And he's like, no, I'm going to cut you off. I don't do this because I think I could be in their position. I do this because I know that I would never be in their position.
Yeah.
And thank you, Noam, wherever you are. You had this answer in this Q&A 15 years or 12 years ago 14 years ago. It lives in my mind rent-free because I always thought that growing up. Like, my parents were like, you know, help your betters. You'll never, you know, like, help people who are worse off than you, rather. Your betters. That's really funny. Help people who bet on you. It's not what it means. But help people who are worse off than you because that's what you do when you have more. That was all my parents needed for an ideology. But I think I was doing a lot of my work, my early work in, you know, HIV activism because I thought, well, oh my goodness, I could be criminalized someday too. You know, like maybe the popo could come for all of us, knock on the door, middle of the night. My goodness. No, no. Double degree owning, polyglot, gay white cis men of middle class coding and no money and therefore not threatening. All I am is credit card debt and a fucking following. This is what I am, and I am the least threatening thing to this system. I'm not going to jail. So this is why we couldn't sleep with this. We could not sleep on this. We had to do something. We knew it was an uphill battle because an omnibus is impossible to fight when you have a majority. So we also had to deal with the apathy of certain elements within our own communities and especially within traditional politics had given up on this. They're like, well, the next 4 years are just, you know, basically it's just being stuck on an escalator, but down. We were like, okay, but for this period, for right now, until this goddamn bill gets to the Senate, we're going to be walking up that fucking escalator. We're not going down on this. We're not going to sleep on this because you have to be able to live with yourself.
Mm-hmm. And so this was... Oh. This was a bill that had been proposed by the conservatives and got through. And
eventually. But we had one.
A lot of people fought this bill.
I'll tell you about the campaign if you want.
Well, yeah, it was called It Could Get Worse, which we thought would be really funny because it was a send-up of the gay campaign, It Gets Better, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and yet it was a nod to it. It was this return to prison as a sort of sacral. It was a mythic prison. Is this being activated? Is the notion of prison as salvatory was being activated under this? And that was another thing we couldn't handle. Because, you know, I was sober for most of this campaign. Like, this is when I discovered sobriety. I thought about all the times I bought and done very many illegal things. And I thought to myself, but that is not something that should be putting anyone in prison. I mean, there's a way that early movements towards drug decriminalization were going to be harder through this. I mean, it is quite interesting that cannabis decriminalization happened despite this omnibus. That was one of the first good ways that I can think of that you undo the omnibus bills, that you take a single substance and be like, let's do this with the whole thing, and you kind of start treading it. So let's get back to It Could Get Worse. We made a video campaign, we made slogans, we made posters, we got out there whenever we knew that there was a conservative showing up. We tried to get to people who were in the orange wave. So thankfully we had Hélène Laverdière, a local ND who had been elected to the NDP on the orange wave. Willie Blom was working for the NDP. We had Justin Ling, the journalist. We had Jason McLean, Chris Zakia. Oh, Laura Beeston helped us out. We had all these people who were journalists who were like, oh, but we're supposed to be objective. And then I'd get people and engage with people online mostly, and they would be like, actually this is bad, like this is like letter to the editor, call your MP bad, get your parents to call your MP. And this is where we activated something similar to the Great Schlep in a way. Like we got people to call their parents back home and get your parents back home to call their shitty MP in their shit town. Sorry, to call their shitty MPs in their gorgeous enclaves of beauty and middle classness way back home, which in my case is a very poor parish in New Brunswick with a bunch of rich boomers in it. And there's a bunch of rich boomers who, like perhaps like my parents, might base their votes on policy and not a knee-jerk belonging to who is in power. They might base their votes on, they might know their candidate, they might know their MP, to remember that there's parts of this representative democracy that people use as tools. You call someone and tell them, no one at my church will ever vote for you if you do blah. That's what's getting all these trends, anti-trans legislation in. So we thought, well, let's try and do that. And so we all did it, we made a petition and we got everyone to call their parents and tell their parents to call their MPs and activated that. And we had one win, Stefano. I just want to mention, I I will send you the name of the one conservative senator who was from Quebec that we got to be the only no vote on when the omnibus got to the Senate. So, of course, it passed the House of Commons. In a world where Harper was seen as a traitor to conservatism...